Today on The Novelizers, The Mindy Project's Adam Pally and Futurama's Maurice LaMarche, plus Clark LaRue Jones and intern Kevin Carter. Now here's your host, Andy Richter.
Technology has given us so much. Modern medicine saved countless lives. Airplanes let us travel the world. The internet puts a wealth of information at our fingertips, and some of it is even true. But sometimes technology moves us in the wrong direction. Movies, for example, they're just not as good as books. A book is something you hold in your hand, reading your own voice, spending as much or as little time with a paragraph as you like. That's why we take movies and get top-notch writers to turn them into books. Then we use podcasts, that's one of the good technologies, to turn those books into something you don't have to read. We call it The Novelizers. This season on the podcast, we're novelizing the alien disaster film Independence Day. And here to catch us up on the story so far is my intern, Kevin. Hey, Kevin, what's happening?
Really? Okay, well, I got this audition for this Chipotle commercial, and when I got there,
No, not what's happening in your life. What's happening in the movie?
Well, Earth is being invaded by aliens who have started blowing up famous landmarks like the White House and Los Angeles. The president barely escaped on Air Force One and is flying around as if being in the sky during an alien attack is a good idea. The generals decide to send Will Smith and Harry Connick Jr. to attack the giant alien ship with jets. And they have this blowing up the Death Star kind of moment, except since this is only 45 minutes into the film, we all know it's not going to work.
Thank you, Kevin. Today's first chapter was novelized by writer Chase Mitchell and narrated by Adam Pally from Iron Man 3 and Sonic the Hedgehog. Adam Pally, novelize us.
Chapter 9, The Few, the Proud, the Smithereens, novelized by Chase Mitchell, narrated by Adam Pally. As the brave squadron of fighter pilots disperse across the jet parking lot, whatever the fuck that's called, our intrepid hero, Captain Stephen Hiller, strode cockily alongside his trusty, totally not doomed best friend, played for some reason by smooth jazz recording artist Harry Connick Jr. I mean, was Chris Isaac busy? Was Dwight Yoakam filming Sling Blade? This can't have been their first choice. Anyway, ever since these two young hotshots had come up in the Air Force Academy together, they'd been inseparable, forming a deep bond based on brotherhood, gently homophobic banter, and being the only two pilots in the movie with speaking roles. Now, after this unprecedented alien attack, the fate of the world's second tier and below cities rested squarely on their shoulders. As the pair made their way to their respective aircraft, Captain Hiller looked stoic and determined. But while he may have carried himself with a youthful air of superiority, like some sort of fresh prince, deep down, he was a ball of nerves. Because unlike at, say, a New Orleans piano bar populated by horny suburban moms at last call, this was not an ideal time to have Harry Connick Jr. as your wingman. In fact, he was already being kind of fucking annoying. "Let's bring it on, let's bring the bad boy on," Connick Jr. yelled directly into Hiller's ear in an accent both cocky and borderline problematic. "You lose?" Connick Jr. inquired further, referring to, of course, Captain Hiller's bowels. A good wingman always checks to see if his fellow pilot is getting enough fiber. Not a lot of people know this, but mid-air diarrhea is what lost us Vietnam. "Yeah," Hiller answered, having fully evacuated his colon mere hours earlier. "You got your victory dance?" he asked back. Harry Connick Jr. responded by producing a cigar from his chest pocket, a cigar which, much like himself at this moment, was not yet on fire. "I got it right here, yeah," Connick Jr. answered in his obnoxious, rat-packy, Harry Connick Jr.-ass kind of way. Hey, don't get prepatcher on me, soldier," Hiller shot back, definitely intending to say premature, though the director for some reason chose not to use a different take for that line. "We don't light up until the fat lady sings." Hiller anxiously glanced around to see if anyone would cancel him for body shaming a hypothetical fat lady, then remembered that Twitter wouldn't be invented for another 13 years. "I'm all ease, brother," Harry Connick Jr. said, which was ironic given that Will Smith was the one who was, in fact, mostly ears. Hiller and his adult contemporary crooning wingman climbed into their respective planes, the latter of which was proudly emblazoned with Harry Connick Jr.'s call sign, Raven, which, I shit you not, is literally the symbol for impending death. "You the man," Harry Connick Jr. called out to his buddy, oblivious to his own impending fiery death. Soon, a cacophony of whoosh sounds filled the air as the fleet of F-15s took to the skies to meet an uncertain fate. Uncertain, except for Harry Connick Jr., who, and we cannot stress this enough, might as well have had the word gunner painted on his flight helmet. Meanwhile, in a secure underground military location surrounded by various beeping and booping screens that looked important but didn't actually do anything, President Thomas Whitmore gathered with his most trusted advisors, who, this being 1996 and all, consisted entirely of vaguely recognizable middle-aged white character actors. "All right, gentlemen, we're on," Whitmore announced to his inner circle authoritatively, though he wasn't totally sure what he meant by that. It was an important moment, and it had seemed like he should say something, but he wasn't clear exactly what was on, or who we were in this scenario, or whether any of the faces around him could actually be considered gentlemen. Whitmore kind of hoped nobody noticed this and just rolled with it. It had sounded like something a president would say in a time of crisis, and besides, he was a little drunk. Thankfully, before anyone could question it, the president's most trusted advisor, General Robert Loggia, was handed a phone from off-screen to rasp his signature grizzled rasp into. "General, it's NORAD," said an extra who got paid the SAG day rate for that line. Loggia clutched the phone in his liver-spotted fingers and raised it to his liver-spotted ear. Everyone knew NORAD's job was tracking Santa Claus on Christmas Eve, so this must be important.
"Rasp," Jen Loggia gurgled into the phone cantankerously. "Raspity rasp. Rasp, rasp."
Drops of spittle flew in all directions. The guy in charge of typing the movie subtitles just shrugged. The president's other advisors tried to interject, but didn't offer much help either. "Our intelligence believes we're looking at a total loss, Mr. President," chimed in that one annoying character actor who always plays a Weasley piece of shit with bad news.
"How about our boys? Where are they?"
President Whitmore asked, referring to the pilots. He was desperate for some good news. The initial alien attack had blown up the White House, which was where he kept his porn.
"ETA to target, 4 rasps,"
rasped General Loggia. The military men gathered around the glowing screen with anticipation, watching eagerly as a bunch of little images of planes inched toward a big ol' image of a fat-ass alien ship. Meanwhile, en route to their intended target, the cadre of fighter jets soared solemnly over the decimated, bombed-out remnants of what was once Los Angeles. Down below, survivors climbed through the city streets, already attempting to gentrify them. The parking lot of a makeshift Trader Joe's was teeming with ass-strewn moms in tattered yoga pants, begging for rations of affordably priced Chardonnay. Nearby, the famous stretch of Hollywood Boulevard was littered in jagged debris and human excrement. It was the only street left unaffected by the blast. Above it all, Captain Stephen Hiller looked on, his mind wandering to the girlfriend and child that he, let's be honest, kind of just left to fend for themselves. "Pretty fucked up, if you ask me. I shouldn't have left her," Hiller muttered to himself correctly, realizing it would have been a way cooler action scene to heroically save them from a shitload of explosions or something. That was like at least 10 or 15 minutes of screen time that he completely let go to waste. Plus, like, they wouldn't be dead now or whatever. His trusty wingman, Harry Connick Jr., deeply in touch with his sensitive side thanks to years of performing treacly smooth jazz standards to bored daytime television viewers, attempted to offer his friend some solace.
"Don't worry about it, man. I'm sure she got out of there before it happened,"
Connick Jr. said, kind of hoping this made up for the time he totally slut-shamed Vivek A. Fox for being a sex worker like two scenes ago. "Or," he suddenly added, drastically overplaying his hand by immediately switching to a stereotypical black preacher voice,
"as the good reverend would say, why are we on this particular mission? We'll never know, but I do know here today that the Black Knights will emerge victorious once again."
The other pilots laughed. They loved when Harry Connick Jr. was a little bit racist. It distracted them from the fact that they were all about to die. "Amen, Reverend," Hiller replied, quietly deciding to himself that if he does survive this mission, he is definitely going to find some cooler friends. Suddenly, as the clouds in front of them dissipated, they were upon it. The giant alien warship. It filled their entire field of vision like a giant fucking alien warship.
"Holy God,"
Harry Connick Jr. said, as if they all hadn't watched these things land on top of every major city in the world and blow them up like 10 fucking minutes ago. Captain Hiller remained steadfast.
"Lock and load," he commanded his squadron, even though get your weapons ready seems like something they would kind of know what to do on their own at this point.
Meanwhile, from the safety of his secure military bunker, General Robert Loggia managed to choke out one dramatic, raspy command.
"Fire at will."
Of course, it would have been funny if the F-15s had taken him literally and fired directly at Will Smith, but instead, they let loose the full power of their payloads on the gargantuan floating starship before them. Within moments, a sky full of explosive projectiles rocketed through the air toward the target, leaving trails of smoke billowing behind. Now was the moment of truth. By the way, this is the part where if you're watching this take place in some kind of visual medium or like motion picture, as it were, you'd be hearing a dramatic orchestral score begin to swell in the background, which would be really, you know, help sell the drama of the situation. Here, I'll try my best. Be-doop, be-doop-doop, be-doop-be-boop. Anyway, you get it. As the pilots looked on in anxious anticipation, their stomachs, and in Captain Hiller's case, bowels, began to drop in horror as each and every missile ignited prematurely against an impenetrable, invisible outer shield, exploding in a green ball of failure instead of an orange ball of victory. Guess that puts the missing missile, one of the pilots could have said, but alas, no one except the narrator was clever enough to think of it. Undeterred, Captain Hiller peeled off from the rest of the squadron along with a smaller group of his most trusted fighters and also Harry Connick Jr. Hiller had a new and brilliant plan. They would fire a second set of missiles roughly 30 feet away from the ones that had just failed to hit that simply had to work. Switching to Sidewinders, Hiller shouted with the blind, naive confidence of a man who truly believed that Wild Wild West would be as big a box office success as Men in Black. The smaller group of jets fired off another volley of missiles, this time extra sidewindy. Come on, said Harry Connick Jr., rooting the missiles on as eagerly as if they were targeting his lifetime mortal enemy, Michael Bublé. But alas, the second strike glanced just as harmlessly off the alien's defenses as the first, and it turns out this extraterrestrial species was advanced enough to cover their whole ship in shields, not just the one side. I guess these aliens are brilliant and sexy, muttered Captain Hiller, quickly adding, brilliant, just brilliant. As the jets continued speeding toward the wall faster than Will Smith's career after he starred in M. Night Shyamalan's movie The Son, Hiller commanded the pilots to pull up, and pull up they did. All except for one poor bastard, who screamed like a 10-year-old girl as he became a red smear on the front of the alien ship. He kind of did it as a bit, but nobody laughed. The remaining jets entered a steep climb towards the top of the enormous ship when suddenly, a glowing green slot opened above them, spewing forth a sea of tiny single-passenger spacecraft, like a colony of fire ants attacking a 4th of July barbecue. Captain Hiller briefly considered impressing the other pilots with his amusing and topical holiday-themed analogy, but there was no time. Punch through! Punch through! He commanded the other pilots, which, to be fair, is kind of easy to say for the main character of a movie to say when pretty much everybody else is about to die horrifically. Hiller, of course, successfully emerged through the enemy maelstrom unscathed, but sure enough, another jet piloted by some other anonymous dipshit wasn't so lucky. There's too many of them, he yelled. His final words on this earth a pathetic cliche as he collided with an alien fighter in a great ball of fire large enough to impress famous cousin fucker Jerry Lee Lewis. Back at the command center, all the president's men huddled around a single screen that helpfully depicted each pilot's aircraft in one of two distinct colors. Green ship meant alive guy. Red ship meant dead guy. More and more ships are turning dead guys, sir, said trusted presidential advisor Captain Obvious. I can see that, said the president, smugly adding, I was a pilot, you know. That will come in handy later. He then turned to the camera and winked. Meanwhile, back at the firefight, Captain Hiller continued to flip and maneuver around the enemy ships with the surprising ease of someone whose name is listed above the movie's title on the poster. Oh no, you did not shoot that green shit at me, he catchphrased, even though, yes, that alien ship had shot that green shit at him and would continue to shoot that green shit at him until the special effects budget for a sequence had scored well enough with the test audiences. Hiller was thankful for that. Before takeoff, he'd remembered to outfit his fighter jet with plot armor, which was really coming in handy right about now. But more than that, he just wanted to survive this battle so he could make it back to his hot stripper girlfriend and her adorable son, whatever his name was. He took evasive action to avoid another enemy fighter. I got you covered, Big Daddy, shouted Harry Connick Jr., firing on the alien ship, trailing his friend. Hiller was thankful for the assist, but vaguely skeeved out by the nickname. Connick Jr.'s missile bounced harmlessly off the alien ship, sending it spiraling out of the firefight faster than the movie Emancipation spiraled out of the Best Actor Oscar conversation. Damn, they got shields too, Connick Jr. said, proving that he was somehow even slower to catch on to this whole they have fucking shields concept than Captain Hiller was. Hiller dabbed sweat off his forehead. He was quickly running out of ideas, much like the live-action adaptation of Disney's Aladdin. Knights move! Knights move! He yelled desperately to his few remaining squadron members. Wait. Did you say night moves? Another pilot said, mistakenly cranking up the volume on a Bob Seger song before getting immediately blown to pieces. Damn, they were dropping like flies. Really, really, really stupid flies. From the command center, President Whitmore looked on as more and more alive guy planes turned into dead guy planes.
All right, get him out of here. This isn't happening fast enough. Get him out of there!
This unwinnable fight had dragged on long enough at the cost of countless American lives. Plus, there was a new episode of Friends starting in a few minutes, and they didn't call it must-see TV for nothing. Suddenly, the feed turned static. They'd lost the connection completely.
Ross and Rachel's blood is on your hands!
The president snarled at his subordinates. Meanwhile, back at the firefight, Captain Hiller had one more idea. He would lead the alien fighters and his one still alive friend from the nightmarish war zone above downtown Los Angeles to the Grand Canyon. There, they would lead them on a heart-pounding chase through the canyon, exactly like Star Wars, but extremely derivative, but in a way less memorable way.
Follow me, Hiller said to Harry Connick Jr. dramatically. I saw this in a movie once. It was a much better movie.
The jets made the harrowing 15-second trip from Southern California to Arizona with the alien spacecraft in hot pursuit.
They're on me like white on rice, Connick Jr. said after a beat, adding, get it? Rice, because I'm from New Orleans.
I get it, Hiller said. Now lose them, Harry, just like I showed you.
Harry Connick Jr. was kind of insulted by this, just like I showed you. Hell, he taught Hiller how to play It Had to Be You on jazz piano, but he wasn't constantly rubbing that in his face.
I'm gonna try something, Connick Jr. announced.
Don't do nothing stupid.
You know me, Connick Jr. said.
Yeah, you tried to start a daytime talk show that competed with Ellen DeGeneres, Hiller said.
He had a good point. Sure enough, Harry Connick Jr. was struggling to outrun the alien. Gasping for breath, he removed his face mask. The universal movie pilot signal for, I'm about to die.
Harry Connick Jr., no! Hiller cried. Zatarans!
Connick Jr. screamed as his ship was blown to pieces. Hiller felt a sudden disturbance in the force as if millions of fans of the Easy Listening channel on Spotify suddenly cried out in terror and were suddenly silenced. Newly emboldened by his friend's fiery and extremely obvious death, Hiller led the alien behind him on a breathtaking chase through the canyon. Again, this is something that would look way cooler than it is to be described. I guess you kind of had to be there.
Where you at, baby? Come on! Come on, you can't hit nothing!
Yelled Hiller as he flew, getting awfully cocky for someone who just watched everyone he knows die in about 8.5 minutes. Suddenly, Hiller saw an opportunity and deployed his parachute directly onto the alien's windshield, distracting it just long enough to cause a head-on collision, a maneuver known as the Laura Bush.
Hope you got an airbag, Hiller shouted mockingly, though he hoped the alien did not, in fact, have an airbag, as that would drastically increase the chances the alien would survive and thus be very upset with him.
The alien ship crash landed, slapping violently across the desert floor like the hand of an A-list actor across the face of a much, much skinnier stand-up comedian. Finally, it skidded to a stop, kicking up a wall of sand and dirt. Hiller's parachute landed nearby, sending him collapsing to the ground in a not very cool way that he was glad no one was around to witness. He angrily climbed up to the face of the alien aircraft and ripped the door off its hinges. He couldn't be sure the alien had said something disparaging about people with alopecia, but he was not sure either. As the alien face emerged from about $15.99 worth of dry ice from Party City, Hiller did the only thing he could think of to do in that moment. He punched the shit out of it.
Welcome to Earth!
Damn, he thought. That was a really cool fucking thing to say. And no one was even alive to hear it. He decided he'd have to repeat that again the next time he was around some people. Exhausted, Hiller finally hit up his victory cigar and collapsed against the hull of the alien ship to rest.
Now that's what I call a close encounter, he said.
Fuck, man, he did it again. Why wasn't he this clever when the people were around? Oh well, he thought. He had a few hours to workshop some other lines.
Thanks. And now here's my intern, Kevin Carter, who interviewed one of the fine folks who worked on the film Independence Day.
I'm here with a guy by the name of Clark, a.k.a. Athlete. Hey, Clark, how's it going?
What's up, Kev? You got to pronounce it Athlete, okay? I put a lot of work into putting the paperwork, talking to the government, getting my name changed appropriately. So you say the whole thing, athlete.
Okay, I apologize. Athlete.
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 Pretend like you went to the University of Alabama.
Uh-huh.
You a new signee, and you're doing your first interview with ESPN. You say athlete.
Okay, athlete.
You can even say A-F-F elite. Both work. I got them all covered under my 501c3.
All right, cool. Yeah. But yeah, whichever one you want me to say, I'll say it. You know, how you doing today? You doing all right?
I'm doing great. I'm ready to talk. Can we do a virtual fist bump?
Yeah, let's do a virtual fist bump.
Boom, clack, clack.
Ouch. I just felt like the way you talk, it just felt like it would hurt if we did a version.
Well, if you were an athlete, it wouldn't hurt that much.
I'm sorry. I have not an athletic bone in my body. I apologize.
I can tell by the sound of your voice. You don't say athlete appropriately. Let's get to these topics.
Yeah, let's get to it. Topic number one. How did you become a harvester?
I grew up in Compton, California. Okay? I grew up with nothing. And being a harvester was a dream of mine. But we didn't have footballs. We threw rocks and had to catch them. So that prepared me for a lifetime to be out of this world. An out of this world athlete. You see how it all tied together?
Yeah, I see how it all.
I'm gonna let you continue. But let me say this first. When you bring up Independence Day, understand that's one of the things that I have not gotten over my entire career. I deserve a rematch.
A rematch with
Will Smith was on PEDs. I have unequivocal proof of that.
So are you saying you were the one that got into the fight with him and when the ship was flying and stuff?
I was the one who got in. I was in the back and I watched the whole thing with my, you know, I was in uniform. It's one team, one band, like that movie Soul Plane.
Yeah, because there was a moment when Will Smith just punched the crap out of an alien. You know what I'm saying? And
that was a stunt double. No alien would ever get punched by someone like Will Smith. All of that is Hollywood, except that Chris Rock punch. Now, I don't know if that was real or not, but I'm willing to recruit. Mark this down. I'm willing to recruit Chris Rock for this rematch against Will, a.k.a. Smith, if that's his real name.
So how did you become involved with the movie Independence Day?
I didn't even know it was a movie. I came fully suited because I wear my uniform every day. Mm-hmm. If you stay ready, you ain't got to get ready.
True.
So I'm walking down, is it Sepulveda? Sepulveda Boulevard. I'm ready to just fight whoever comes across me. And all of a sudden, here come cameras and trucks and Will Smith himself. I don't know if it was him or Dwayne Martin. They looked alike. Might have been a body double. Vivica Fox, she a stripper in the movie. How did that happen? My suggestion.
So were you the reason Vivica A. Fox was a stripper?
I'm the reason it was Vivica Fox before me. She had spelled it two X's like Jamie. And I said, no. We're going to replace that X with an A and move it to the middle.
So you're the reason she goes by Vivica A. Fox. It was just Vivica Fox before you came into the picture.
She was Vivian Leanne Westwood Fox.
Wow. Okay. Did not know that at all. You're a very important person in Hollywood. I apologize.
It's called word economy, Kevin.
Yeah.
You can't have too many letters. And give me my credit, which they never did. I'm pissed off.
Growing up, what made you feel that, you know what I'm saying, you was that guy? You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm an athlete. You know what I'm saying? And I'm ready to do whatever it calls for me to do. And I'm in impeccable shape. And I'm ready to do this. What made you think of that as a child?
As a kid, I was into everything. I was a jack of all trades, whether it's sewing, baking a pimento loaf, or playing around with neighborhood kids. It was always good to me. If you're good at something, never do it for free. So I did everything, and I charged them a nominal fee.
So I mean, like, so when they called you to be an alien?
No, first of all, nobody called me. Okay, except God. God called me from birth. It was very Supermanish. And I was like, wait, who was that? Let me click over real quick, because I was on the other line with T-Mobile. I said, hold on, T-Mobile, let me call this. I got to take this. This the Lord, the head of the galaxy. And he want me to play for the greatest team of all time, the Harvesters. And I was like, you know what? That name don't really strike me like that. But I'm a team player.
Who was there a coach? Who was the coach of the Harvesters?
You can't coach the Harvesters. We play kind of like pickup ball, you know? No coaches, no referees. Just get out there and be successful. Like that movie, The Longest Yard.
With your ongoing beef, as I would call it, with Will Smith, has that been resolved? Because, I mean, it happened a long time ago. It's almost 30 years ago. That happened a long time ago. Is there still animosity between you two?
My beef is non-vegan. So it's actual meat. If I catch him, it's on sight. You understand? That's embarrassing. This is my one shot. I'm about to kill Fresh Prince. And then they just cut it. My beef is with the editors.
But do you feel Will Smith has something to do with that?
Will Smith got something to do with everything. He's the king of Roku City. Y'all didn't know that. Y'all thought it was a uncharted territory. But he is the president, mayor, and king of Roku City, which was stolen by Prince because it's all purple. And I'm just giving away too many Hollywood secrets right now. I'm almost late for my Illuminati meeting.
You're blowing my mind right now. This is a lot.
This is Illuminati trying to call me right now. I ain't clicking over. They ain't gonna get me twice.
Yeah, I don't want to be involved in that at all. I would greatly appreciate it if you didn't click over.
They changed their number to God in my phone, so I would fall for it, but I ain't. I'm the comptroller of Roku City.
Yeah. So when you was asked to be a harvester, was there any doubt that you would?
If I got to tell your ass one more time, don't nobody ask athlete to do nothing. I show up and I show out.
How did you hear about the Harvesters team?
I got a message from a little birdie, and it went.
Was it a literal bird?
It was Larry Bird.
Oh wow!
AKA Lawrence Bartholomew Birdstein. That's my agent.
Did you give him an A?
He's my agent.
I thought you named him Larry A. Bird or something. I didn't know.
Nope. I don't name everything. What? I'm not getting paid for that.
Have you ever lost?
Lost what? My goddamn mind? Never. Don't believe what those tabloids tell you.
So, yeah. So, I want to thank you for the interview. This has been a very fun interview with, and I want to make sure I get it right. Athlete.
This is the scenario. It's first and goal. You are on your 10th time taking the LSAT. Nobody asked you to do it. The SAT, not for you. If you don't get this first down, you won't go to the league. You get the first down, touchdown, boom. Here come Kirk Herbstreit, Lee Corso. Tell us about yourself. How does it feel? You just won the Ironclad Bowl. How does it feel to be the hero? And you got to say, well, as a student athlete, it means nothing more to me. Not only to win this touchdown, but as I was running, I heard my mama yell out, baby, you got a 139 on your LSAT. And that's what gave me the drive to keep going.
Wiser words has never been said, ladies and gentlemen.
Shout out to my
you
mama.
Heard it, you heard it here first, you know, and I want to pay respects to Mama Leet. You know, as a Mama Leet, seems like a nice lady.
And my older brother, Math Elite.
Oh, you got Math Elite as well.
But that's another time for another conversation.
Not a problem. I understand it. I want to thank you for joining us today. I am Kevin Carter. Please enjoy the rest of this podcast.
Ah, sublime. Our next chapter was novelized by Shet Baker and narrated by Maurice LaMarche. Monsieur LaMarche, novelize us.
Chapter 10, The Audience Pees. Novelized by Shek Baker. Narrated by Maurice LaMarche.
Mother led Dylan through the ruins with the dog close behind. Moments ago, she had pulled them both through the metal door in the automobile tunnel, and they'd emerged eons later, deafened and dumbstruck, into the wastes, wiped clean of all living matter. Gone as if never built, with the tall buildings, the automobiles, the omnibuses. Gone as if never born, the teeming people. Instead, an evil sun, dripping brownish light through a fouled scrim of sky onto a basin of dust, hilled with heaps of flaming slag and bricks, pounded to ash, all splotched here and there with stains of burnt blood. So now Dylan and Mother picked their way across the city's blasted remains, in an aimless daze. Mother had little to say, only retching sometimes on the fetid air while scrambling forward, huffing from one annihilated hillock to the next. The dog followed at heel, its mouth full of gritted drool, sniffling and snorting its unpleasant sounds, its filthy coat caked with its own moist leavings it had rolled through. There had been other people in the automobile tunnel, other mothers and sons, perhaps, desperate for shelter from the blinding inferno. And Mother had called out an offer of rescue only to the wretched dog. Up ahead, a darkness towered above, a massive shadow gliding toward them. Uneasily, they trundled forward into a sour breeze, and at length the looming hulk pierced the sullied gauze, shrouding the landscape, and took shape. A section of highway overpass. Mother glanced at the boy, a hunger awake in her eyes. He met the glance with a silent nod. "Go on, then, Mother. Lead." She did. He and the animal followed her cautious footsteps ahead, and soon another object, both familiar and stunning at once, emerged from the smog. An old refrigerator. Fully intact, upright, its door wide open to reveal scattered bottles of condiments on the shelves. Dylan could not begin to grasp how a force mighty enough to erase the skyscrapers of the commercial core had met this fridge and done nothing but pop the latch open. Mother, though, had something else on her mind. "Baby, stay right here. Stay right here with Boomer," she said, a mixture of fear and excitement in her voice. "Of course, Mother," thought Dylan, and turned a twisted smile toward the dog. "Right here with Boomer." Mother wandered off toward the overpass while the beast sniffed around the appliance. Dylan scowled. How he loathed this hairy yellow thing, had always loathed it, since the first time he laid eyes on it 2 Christmases past, while Mother and Will Smith beamed down at him in expectant glee. His heart's desire that year had been a 16-bit gaming console on which to enjoy NBA Jam, or perhaps Street Fighter II. Nothing complicated, certainly nothing that would excrete and consume its own shit. But no, his reveries of endless happy afternoons schooling Mother with slammer jammers and hadokens finished in a blink when this mongrel emerged from a pet carrier, a red ribbon fixed to its collar, and slavered on his Jordans. Dylan had done his best then to look merry, catching a revolted gag in his throat and forcing it back down. "Oh, Mother, of course I am well pleased by it. How darling it is." A lie. But of course Will Smith did think the dog was darling, had convinced Mother to buy the dog, had named the dog. Will Smith himself practically was a dog, the way he vied for Mother's affections, so eager to please, and the way he turned over and over in the soil with the dog, the both of their tongues hanging loose as they cavorted in the filth of the earth. How Dylan wished he could line them both up and drive an infinity of hadokens into their simpering goddamned faces. The idiot creature turned from the fridge and grinned up at Dylan, lolling its slimy tongue out of its grime-smeared mouth. Under Mother's eye in Mother's home, he had played the good son, patting the cur's repellent body when bidden, pouring its meals of rank kibble, pausing his games to follow the dog outside and watch it expel its stinking excretia. But now, with Mother in such a state, perchance an opportunity for an unfortunate mishap. Will Smith, Dylan had to think, was nothing more than a shadow on the ground now, thanks to the spacemen. One down. He looked from the dog to the gaping refrigerator, then back again. "The doors of these are notorious," he thought. "If some poor thing climbed in, maybe to examine a chunk of sausage lodged deep in the back." He began rooting around in the dust, looking for anything that might tempt the mutt. His hands discovered something unexpected. He stood, lifting a hunk of plastic out of the mess, and the dog waved its tail, oblivious to the boy's disappointment. He held only the remains of a cheap toy truck. A sudden loud noise broke his spell, and he whirled toward it, dropping the toy. Oblivion from the skies? No. A truck. A man-sized truck, roaring to life, followed by faint sounds of Mother's triumph. He squinted and saw her bouncing and hand-dancing in the cab of a road maintenance vehicle, totally unscathed, parked under the overpass. Unscathed and without a speck of dirt on her. Dylan held the sides of his head in confusion. First the fridge, now this truck, and wait, no, it went farther than that. The tunnel. The tunnel. The metal door, the tunnel, the fridge, this antique truck. They all had metal doors, and all the metal doors had turned back the fury of the alien blast like it was nothing but a weak breeze. This, Dylan contemplated. Mother beckoned from the cab and Boomer dashed toward her, with Dylan close behind. But not all wasted spaces on Earth needed aliens to make them that way. Out in a white desert shadowed by brown mountains, the people of the RV camp were packing up everything. Lawn chairs, tarps, coolers, rugs, kids, babies, grannies, everything outside got rolled up, folded, and shoved into motorhomes or piled on top and bungeed down. Pickups with camper tops and Winnebagos chugged past as Alicia watched from the front window of the family RV and half listened to the numbing soundtrack laid down by the TV news.
Reports indicate that this battle has repeated itself all over the world with the exact same results.
Alicia switched him off. She knew how that one ended. She kept busy trying to stow her own family's things in the RV's crowded overhead spaces as people scurried by on foot holding suitcases.
Good luck, suitcase guys, thought Alicia.
They probably had as good a chance as any of them, honestly. She glanced into the back of the RV, where Randy Quaid was fumbling with a washcloth near her little bro's head. Finally, Randy just kind of left the cloth on her brother's face and stood up, adjusting his Aloha shirt.
See, Troy?
Randy said to the ailing boy with the confidence of a lush, promising himself he could stop it too.
You're feeling better already.
Randy wrung his hands together while Troy lay there shaking his head and trying to move the wet cloth off his eyes and nose. Alicia hugged her bare arms and looked toward the dashboard, cluttered up with food wrappers, clothes, bags, and other crap they probably wouldn't need real soon. The door to the RV burst open and Miguel climbed in, sweat-soaked in his undershirt. He barely looked at Alicia.
"How yourself, big bro?"
Miguel locked eyes with Randy as Randy itched his own neck. Miguel offered a shrug.
"Everyone's packing up," he said to Randy's blank face.
"They're leaving," Miguel added a moment later. Alicia and Miguel spent a lot of time spoon-feeding Randy Quaid info like that because he was a drunk idiot who believed nonsense. Sure, he'd been right about the aliens, okay. The broken clock that was right once a life. Randy hunkered and lurched toward the cab as Miguel continued.
"They said there's a spaceship headed this way."
"We'd better leave, too, don't you think?"
said Randy, and he was seriously asking, like, maybe staying could work, too? Miguel let out a heavy sigh and exchanged a look with Alicia. She couldn't exactly read Miguel's mind, but thought she caught the gist. They'd be driving a real long time before they found someplace even further beneath anyone's notice.
"Thousands of feet above, Air Force One was flying casual over the nation's western mountains, covered by a couple of little fighter jets. Not sure what the plan would be if the aliens found them. Shit their pants and die? Good luck, fellas. But that was B-roll. Down on the Air Force One set, Dave, an extra, was watching with excitement as the place filled up with characters. Could they even be main characters? Like people with lines? Dave thought maybe so. Oh, shit. Judd Hirsch and Jeff Goldblum just got there from makeup. People with lines, people with scenes, people with careers, baby. A couple seconds later, the second AD called over all the background actors. Dave, glad to be off his ass, walked over, trying to look jaded as fuck. Finally, some shit to do. There were about 24 of them all together. Some guys, like Dave, wore dark suits. Some other folks were in, like, full Navy dress. And some women had uptight professional looks. A real boring bunch, dull and ready to be background. The second AD was pointing at people and putting them into two smaller groups. Now, the second AD was talking.
"You in this group,"
he said to the group in which Dave was not.
"You're group one. Whenever Mr. Emmerich says action, you guys are going to hold papers and kind of mill around on the plane looking at them."
A PA motioned these folks over to a prop table piled with fancy-looking binders.
"One, please,"
said the PA.
"Everyone take just one binder, please."
Everyone took just one binder and wandered back toward the second AD.
"And everyone in this group,"
the second AD said, pointing to the group Dave was in.
"You're group two. When Mr. Emmerich says action, you are all going to start walking back and forth in the aisles of the plane. You're going to look like you have someplace real important to be. You're going to brush past people, and you're not going to touch the actors. Got it?"
Fuck yeah, they all got it. Dave getting it probably the most. The second AD nodded at them.
"Questions?"
A woman in group one piped up, which annoyed the second AD, who seemed a bit too impatient for questions for a guy who just asked if anyone had questions.
"Yes, should we be crying?"
she asked.
Or looking devastated or like that? Because everyone in our lives has just died, right? They got blown up?"
Some people seemed to dig this idea. None of them had a script, of course, but pretty much everyone knew this was the movie where aliens blow everything the fuck up. The second AD took a deep breath. Was he counting to himself? Then he spoke a bit louder, a bit more like to slow children.
This group,
he said curtly, pointing at group one.
This group mills around. This group looks at papers. Are you near another person with papers? Okay, look at the papers together. Pretend to ask each other about the papers.
He swiveled and pointed at Dave's group.
This group. This group walks up and down.
He used his hands and arms to mimic what walking up and down might look like.
This group looks busy. This group brushes against people.
The second AD took another deep breath, let it out.
Both groups. You're doing your duty. You're being professional. You're...
He paused, making eye contact with several of them.
At work. Hmm?
Everyone agreed. And everything that happened after that ruled. The lady with the question got put in a group by herself, the emergency backup group by the crash services, and the rest of them milled around looking at papers or walked back and forth, brushing past people. Dave was psyched. First, there was a scene with Judd Hirsch and Goldblum, a sticky thing where Goldblum was airsick, and Judd was like saying how not airsick he was and making Goldblum more airsick. And the whole time, one of the Group 1 leaders sat next to Judd, pretending to be totally into her briefing paper. Like, huh, a very interesting paper. Maybe about how the aliens just blew up her whole family, and Taxi is sitting there telling Brundlefly how much barf he doesn't do on airplanes. Dave was playing so cool, walking back and forth and looking busy, but honestly, holy shit, Goldblum's first gig was raping Charles Bronson's wife and turning him into Death Wish. And now, look at the guy, doing vaudeville on Air Force One with Dear John. People forgot Dear John, but that shit ran for 4 seasons. Totally sick. Then the next scene was Goldblum wandering away, and his movie ex, Margaret, had a moment with Judd about how her and Goldblum should bone again. Judd's telling her, "All you need is love," from John Lennon, and said it was sad that John got shot. Dude, what else was sad was that John Lennon smacked his wives around after he got home from chain-fucking 1,000 teenagers. Dave got to brush past Margaret pretty close in that scene, and it was dope as hell. Next, they moved the action to a different part of the plane, set with couches where President Pullman and a bunch of his top guys, one of them was Rip Torn? No, Robert Loggia. Anyway, they all looked shocked and argued about using nukes on the aliens. Pullman spent a lot of his time with his mouth hanging open, kind of resting on his hands and not saying shit. Then Goldblum wandered in from maybe puking. Or was he looking for the puke room and just tripped over the president's couch? Go wherever you want, Goldblum. The Secret Service is all blown to shit. Anyway, there was this one dude playing a bald, creepy guy who was really pushing the nukes on Pullman. And then Goldblum started ranting about nuclear winter. And they all had a great shout fight until Judd also wandered in and started going on about the UFOs in Roswell. And everyone was so embarrassed for Judd. And Pullman started to escort him out of the sofa lounge with this, come on, we both know this is crazy talk, smirk on his face. But then Bald Creepy looked like he was in the middle of a super hard shit and then dropped that, yes, actually, the Roswell thing happened and no one in the government got to know about it except for all the baldest creeps. Holy shit, the first thing the president did in the whole scene, aside from look like his own dick fell off, and he was 100% wrong about it. Was the president of this movie supposed to suck so bad at it? Then the second AD sent everyone home and said some of the extras could come back the next day and be like survivors of the attack and they get to have blood makeup and wear fucked up clothes. But Dave had a lunch shift at Mel's Drive-In on Sunset, which was a bummer, but hey, that's rock and roll, baby! Meanwhile, Boomer was a very good dog, and he rode in the big truck with his favorite boy, Dylan. He looked at Dylan and wagged his tail. And Dylan looked at him, too, and Boomer was very happy. It smelled real bad around, and it was all on fire. The truck made loud noises when it bunked things out of the way, and Boomer was in the truck, and Dylan was in the truck, and Mother was driving the truck, and where was Will Smith? Will Smith wasn't in the truck. Boomer missed Will Smith, but there were lots of new friends in the truck who were sad and hurt, and new friends made Boomer happy, too. All day, Mother drove the truck around, and Boomer rode in the truck with Dylan, and then the truck stopped, and Boomer got to help find friends with his nose. A lot of the friends Boomer found were dead, and the dead friends didn't ride in the truck. Some of the friends died in the truck, and those friends got a special ride out the back of the truck when the truck stopped. Bye, friends! Mother stopped the truck again, and Boomer smelled more friends to find. He got down off the truck and looked for the friends, and Mother got down off the truck, and a dirty man friend got down off the truck, and Dylan stayed in the truck, but Boomer would be back in the truck later, and Dylan would be there too.
Mother and the dirty man friend found another dead friend on the ground, but Boomer found a friend who was alive under a metal door. He jumped on the metal door on top of the friend and barked. Whoops, he maybe hurt the friend. This friend was a lady, and Mother and the man friend came over and took the metal door off the lady, and she started to die. Shit! Mother and the man friend put their paws on the lady friend, and she kept dying, and Will Smith wasn't there, and Boomer was sad. But Dylan was in the truck, and Boomer would go back in the truck and ride in it with Dylan and his new friends. Maybe they would also find Will Smith. And Boomer wagged his tail and looked at Dylan and thought about Will Smith, and Dylan looked at Boomer too, and Boomer was happy.
Hundreds of miles to the east, the downed space invader was having a very bad day. This barren Earth biome was hot, and being inside the Earth person's descent-decelerating blanket made it even hotter. The invader's motor functions had been impaired when their attack pod crashed, and their nervous system had been further impaired by the Earth person's fist strike to their cranial protuberance. But nothing had been more impaired than their pride. None of their fellow invaders had crashed their attack pods. They had all killed dozens of the Earth people in their worthless cave planes and gone back to the ship to feast. But where was this invader? Down on the surface, hungry, unable to summon forth movement in their limbs, and developing a friction rash from getting dragged across the hot Earth floor by this angry Earth person. The invader's auditory organs were throbbing as well, both from the impact of the crash and from the Earth person's constant screeching. Why had this Earth person so much to say? The invader would never know. For while each invader had been issued a simple digital phrasebook prior to the fleet's arrival, one, said phrasebook was still jammed under the seat of the attack pod. Two, said phrasebook was written in only the Earth language Mandarin Chinese, which this particular Earth person did not appear to speak. And three, said phrasebook contained only rudimentary commands such as die or you will die now or direct me to your gender-neutral mucus replenishment chamber. Perhaps this Earth person intended to drag the invader back to its cave home, thence to mate with them. A much-deserved end to a humiliating day for this humbled invader. Just then, the Earth person ceased its forward movements in order to direct several foot strikes into the invader's genitalia, forcing the release of more mercaptans from their thiolytic sacs. Each mercaptan release seemed to further enrage the Earth person, who responded with more screeching. Look, Earth person, if you don't want to be drenched in the malodorous compounds ejected by an invader's genitalia, stop directing foot strikes towards their thiolytic sacs. It is that simple. The Earth person shortly resumed its trudge across the surface, but soon stopped and began shrieking at greater volume than before, a sound joined by a gathering rumble the invader could both hear and feel through the ground. The invader directed their echolocating organs toward the source of the disturbance and received pulses from hundreds of large ground vehicles moving rapidly in their direction. A feeling of deep unease developed in the invader's digestive cavity. This awful day would likely not improve. Before long, the vehicles arrived at their location. The invader's eco-circulation pump froze as the Earth person traded screeches with one of the vehicle pilots. After a few excruciating moments, the hands of a dozen Earth persons were on them, rolling, folding, and shoving them, descent-decelerating blanket and all into the storage crevice of one of the vehicles. Soon, they were being carried along in the midst of the Earth person's surface fleet, perhaps towards a whole village of cave homes. Who knew? These massed vehicles would present an inviting enough target to any invader ship that might happen by. But this invader knew enough not to hope for such a merciful end. No invader ship would bother wasting its weapon fuel on such insignificant rabble as this.
Thanks, Maurice. And that's all the time we have for today. Join us next time for chapters novelized by Andy Daly and Chris Parnell. Oh boy, that'll be a fun one. Till then, Kevin, land this spaceship.
Thanks, Andy. And thanks to this week's guest contributors, Chase Mitchell, Adam Pally, Sheck Baker, Maurice LaMarche, and Clark Jones. More info about all of our guests can be found in the show description. The Novelizer was created by Stephen Levinson, produced by Stephen, Chris Karwowski, Rob Kuttner, and Suchetis Bokil. Editing, mixing, and mastering by Chris. Improv booking by Christine Bullen. Music by Cole Emoff. Art direction by Crystal Dennis, with illustrations by Barry Crane. Intro narration by Robin Reed. Interviews by me, Kevin Carter. Special thanks to Luke Dennis and Peter Hayes at YSO Public Radio in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Check out thenovelizers.com for more info about the show and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and occasionally TikTok. If you enjoy The Novelizers, please support us on Patreon or email thenovelizers@gmail.com to sponsor an episode. Until next time, I'm Kevin Carter, and as always, Novelizers out.